Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. Today I am joined by George Stocker. George, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Could you let everyone know a little bit about who you are and what you do to give some context for what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, as Jonathan said at the top, I'm George Stocker. I've been a software developer for about 18 years now. Prior to being a software developer, I was in the Army. And then I got out, started doing software development professionally, and have since then been in both large corporations, small corporations, startups, B2B SaaS, everything across the spectrum with all types of team sizes. And then a few years ago, I had the opportunity to go independent, and I took it. And since then, I've been doing subcontracting while still trying to niche down and actually create my own business where I don't have to trade time for money.
Mm-hmm. Great. Perfect. And can you tell folks a little bit more about your any specialties or what sorts of things you've done inside of software development?
Yeah, so I focus primarily on .NET through my career, which is the Microsoft stack akin to Java. And I have worked in a lot of different programming stacks, but that's the one that I've worked longest in. And the most type of work that I've done is legacy modernization, where large enterprises and medium-sized enterprises have .NET applications that have gotten long in the tooth. Mm-hmm. And their choices that they face are either rewrite or find some way to make use of this .NET application in the brand new world we have where cloud is a thing. And so much of my work is architectural in nature, helping teams figure out how to split up their monoliths, helping teams figure out what to rewrite and what not to rewrite and how to use something that's made so much money for their business over the years without trying to pour heavy costs of a Big Bang rewrite into it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen so many times And rather than me talk about my experience, what has your experience been when people do a big rewrite?
Yeah. So as someone who has made this mistake myself, thinking that I could possibly rewrite an application in less of a time than it took to write it initially, the biggest mistake is that people thinking that, hey, if we just rewrite this thing, we will solve all the problems we used to have. We won't have any new problems, and it will take half the time it took us in the first place, none of which are true. So people run into long slogs where they're, you know, they've committed to the rewrites, they've sunk cost fallacy of saying, I have to rewrite. And then once they get into that, then they realize, oh, crap, this old system that's still making us money has a lot of ins and outs and what have yous that we didn't know about. And now they're stuck in a place where, you know, they feel committed to finishing the rewrite, but at the same time, they're not seeing stakeholders, they're not seeing the value from a rewrite that they were pitched by their architects and by their development teams. So these projects end up getting canceled, people get fired, and then the business is still stuck with this old monolith that it's increasingly finding a hard time to maintain, and it still needs to make money and evolve in an ever-changing business landscape. And so it just the problem compounds upon itself. Now, through sheer force of will, sometimes the rewrites work, but it typically is sheer force of will.
Right. And you just end up with new problems.
Yes. And the circle starts again.
Yeah. And you get one of my, I can't even, there's so many stories popping into my mind. I have never heard of one of these things going well ever.
No. Joel Spolsky in the early 2000s wrote Things You Should Never Do Part One. And he references the Netscape rewrite that shouldn't have happened from 4 to 6 and how that tanked Netscape. But that, you know, while that's a famous example, we're seeing, you know, hundreds and thousands of little examples pop up every day. And the problem, like one of the projects that I was part of that failed that got me into, okay, you know, now we need to actually like focus on how to do this right, is that when businesses make a bet, they don't realize that how long the investment is for or how short the investment is for. And what I mean by that is saying, hey, I would like to use, you know, fancy new technology. Well, fancy new technology is either going to have a lot of warts that you don't know about, or it's going to work. And then you have to deal with those warts. If it fails, you still have to like deal with the fact that the business landscape is changing around you. For instance, the introduction of cloud, and that people, the software developers you have underneath you that are working on this thing, they don't have, they don't necessarily want to stay in the old world forever. You know, they want to increase and grow their careers. So there's a lot of forces that are pushing and pulling that make a rewrite both attractive and deadly.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the main thing that I've seen is that the developers who are usually advocating really hard for a rewrite because they don't want to become a dinosaur and they're sick of the old code base. It's really frustrating. They want to work on shiny new cool stuff like they see all the cool kids doing. And so there's all of these non-business related motivations for the developers to be advocating for it. And then the business maybe is convinced, but you know, it's really naive. I don't think I've ever seen one of these things go well. So, all right. So this isn't really a show about how to do it or that it's a bad thing. I mean, that's not the point. The point is how do you connect with someone who needs you in this situation so that you can help them avoid what is almost surely going to be a tragic situation? So, so that's the main question for today. It's kind of a positioning thing, but it's going to feel more exploratory than that. It's not just like, hey, let's come up with some positioning statements and see which ones seem like they would work hypothetically. So let's talk about, there's a bunch of different ways to tackle this kind of a thing. The one that I like to start with, if possible, is the who. So if the problem is, well, let's articulate the problem. And this is sort of the underlying problem. And I would sort of summarize what we've been talking about as, you know, there's a consideration on the table to do a big bang rewrite. And there's a push and pull. There's some desire to do it and some fear about doing it. So that's kind of the situation. Is that really the problem, though? Or is the problem that, like, why is it a problem at all? Why not just stay on the monolith?
Yeah. So what the business is seeing is they're seeing longer time to get features out. They're mm-hmm. seeing more outages and more regression bugs. And they're seeing increased maintenance costs. That is that their team is spending a lot of time putting out fires in their system instead of delivering, you know, what hopefully gives the business its competitive advantage.
Okay. So a CEO or somebody in leadership inside of a company, depending on how big the company is, maybe it's a department head or something, or an SVP or what, it doesn't matter, but it's somebody in charge of a big budget. And they've got this software that is, like you said earlier, getting long in the tooth. It's got all these problems. There's just regression error, all these things.
Now, I should point out there's one other aspect to this that you also see this, and that's also when a business has commissioned an MVP, typically from an offshore team, mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be offshore. It's just any situation where the people who are building the software, their values are not aligned with the people buying the software. Mm-hmm. And so they build something quickly. The business uses it. When they're small, they see traction with it. This is great. By the time they realize that there are so many hidden traps in this thing, it's too late. They've built right. their whole business off of it. Mm-hmm. And so now they're trying to scale, which is where I've currently trying to position myself on that side of things. They're trying to scale and realizing this can't do it. And they're seeing outages, they're mm-hmm. seeing regression bugs, and they're losing sales because of it.
Okay. I would categorize these as, this is interesting because it's very, you're basically using the same skill set, but I would characterize these as two almost unrelated types of symptoms or underlying diseases. So the mindset, unless I'm mistaking you, but like if somebody's trying to scale an MVP without doing the legwork of properly architecting and so forth, that feels like a very different scenario than like we've got this giant monolithic thing that we need to do something about because it's causing business problems. Am I misunderstanding how big the MVP is, or do you agree that those are different scenarios?
Those are different scenarios, but because of their impact on the business. In the latter case, if we've just got a big monolith, you know, we've got to do something about it. You can limp along. You can duct tape it. In the case of an MVP, the problem they're running to is more acute and more urgent. That is, we have to scale either because our VCs want us to, or our private equity group or whoever, or bootstrapped, like we need to make more money. And this isn't doing it. So they're seeing it from a, not from just a cost savings and not just from a maintenance perspective, but they're seeing it from an acute, we actually need more money to come in the door perspective.
Mm. Okay. So whenever I hear the word more acute, I lean toward that, you know, like limping along, doesn't sound great. Like if the business can limp along and like maintain the status quo, in a sales meeting with someone like that, I'd be like, go ahead. I don't want to get involved with something unless you're feeling like severe pain, because I know what a mess these things are. It's not a small problem it's a major undertaking to deal with any of these things, in a sort of monolithic scenario. And if they're comfortable limping along, I'd be like, there's no value here. You know, like, the example I use is underfunding public education in the US. Like, almost anybody is going to say like, yeah, teachers aren't paid enough, or yeah, teachers shouldn't have to be buying paper for their kids or whatever. And a lot of people will agree with that as suboptimal, let's say. it's a problem, but the symptom, it affects everybody differently and nobody owns it. So like, whose problem is it, and what symptoms does that problem, how does that problem present itself in different people? Because it's going to present differently. That same root cause is going to present differently to the students, to the parents of the students, to the teachers, to the administrators in the school, to the city officials, to all the way up the food chain to like federal officials. Everybody's going to have a different symptom from that same problem. So with something like a big monolithic system that is capable of limping along, and they can kind of just throw more devs at it, then unless I was talking to the CEO or someone way, way up the organization who had autonomy and a lot of budget and had what I believe to be a major, I don't want to say the word problem, like a major symptom that was just, they were like, look, this is going to be the existential level system problem. So like, they're like, this will be we're losing customers. Amazon's coming into the space. We're in a race for our lives. If we don't do something about this, we're probably gone. Now my ears are perked up. But if I'm talking to somebody in a sales interview in the sort of legacy monolith model, that's just like, this isn't an existential crisis. I'm like, I'd rather not touch it, unless I was maybe doing something very small in advisory, so something like that. But anyway, when I imagine those two scenarios, the other one being, you know, somebody's got a private equity firm that's just like, this is our chance. The proof of concept is working. We're destroying the brand because of the fail whale is popping up, you know, every day. Then that to me is like, that sounds like a scenario that's A, probably much more fixable. Could be wrong there. That's a big assumption, but probably more fixable, just because probably because the size of the code base and the cultural situation is going to be way more. Everyone's going to want to fix it.
Right. Everybody's aligned. In the other situation, you have a lot of people with a lot of different agendas and they're not all aligned.
100%. Right. So for the purpose of this conversation, let's drill into this scaling the MVP angle. What kind of companies are we talking about here? In your experience, what kind of companies are we talking about? Is there a vertical that you are most familiar with, or one where there's really a lot of money at play? You know, I don't know, fintech, for example, or something big.
Yeah. So I've seen it across a few verticals, but I don't know if B2B SaaS is actually a vertical. That sounds like an entire set of verticals.
It's a starting place, yeah.
But in B2B SaaS, and the other condition that caused this is generally that misalignment. It's generally that first initial team that built it is not the team that has it now. Generally because they offshored, or generally because they got, you know, a consultancy to build them their MVP and, you know, use their initial seed round or pre-seed round on that. And then they're now they're in a different situation. So it is generally because people who grow organically that bootstrap, they don't have this issue because they can keep up with it. You know, they didn't come into the situation late. They were planning for this. But generally VC wise, they're planning for their next round. It's a very different, it's a short-term versus a long-term mindset. And so those people with that short-term mindset, because they have to. Like, they're like, hey, we're not going to have runway in 6 months. So it really doesn't matter if this thing, you know, is going to fail us at, you know, 100,000 users if we can't even launch it for 100 users. And so it's there. It's that type of, I don't know if I'd call it a psychographic, but it's that type of situation that generally makes this occur.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love that it's definitely not bootstrapped. Outsourced MVP. So there's a lot of things here that are somewhat outwardly identifiable. There's still a little bit inside the company. You might not know if they outsource the MVP, for example, but can we drill in more? What are some of the verticals that are most common in B2B?
Yeah. So with customers, potential customers, clients I've been talking to when I've been doing research into this space, I've seen it in the marijuana industry and in somewhat with AI, but less so. It looks like they have a different set of issues around DevOps. ML DevOps. But I've seen around the marijuana industry, I've seen around B2B SaaS where they're targeting, they're going up the verticals. So they start targeting small companies. Now they're targeting larger companies and they're finding these issues. Regulated space. So insurance. So in insurance, because one of the issues they have is they both have a lot of changing regulations in some verticals. So like in the alcohol and beverage industry. But in other verticals like life insurance or health insurance, they have to either figure out new plans to offer or local regulations to deal with. And so their change comes from trying to build and maintain a system that can handle those changes that come just out of the wind, a whim.
Yep. But are these monoliths or are these like insurance doesn't, I don't really think, or even alcohol doesn't feel like new enough. Are there a lot of disruptors in these spaces that are trying to come in with MVPs or?
Yeah, that's where you're seeing when private equity makes a move. So money goes to where it gets its greatest return. Mm-hmm. You see them saying, okay, we've got some money in the stock market. Now let's put some money into these companies and grow these companies. So in one situation, it would be like internet sales of alcohol. Mm-hmm. That's an actual industry that is growing and that has a lot of online changes, partially due to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so you see that in that space. Of course, marijuana, I don't know that space as well, but as I was talking to some customers in that space, they've also had those issues. And that's primarily because the industry itself is growing because it's being legalized and decriminalized, mm-hmm. Legalized in some states, decriminalized in others. And that's causing that industry to grow. So they're starting to see those pains.
So give me a sense of, can you give me an example to just kind of instantiate it for me? Like what's a B2B SaaS look like in the marijuana industry? Is it like
what? Yeah. So you can deal with, they're dealing with different parts of the supply chain, but they're also, so they could be direct between the growers and distributors, but it could also be between like an online marketplace for, so in certain states you can buy it in an online marketplace, or you have this software handles the point of sale for those local marijuana shops. So it handles the logistics and the POS management in those shops.
Okay, so we're kind of talking like SAP for weed, Square for weed, and Shopify for weed.
Basically, yeah.
Okay. And there are, and you're telling me that people don't use Square and Shopify and SAP, they have, or NetSuite maybe, they are using some stuff that's specific to their industry, or certainly there are companies that are trying to be the NetSuite of weed.
Exactly, because of social and legal issues and financial issues. Mm-hmm. If you say to your bank, oh, by the way, yeah, we sell weed, that could have a different impact on you and on your business and on anybody that does business with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because stigma or?
Stigma and just regulations. Okay. Banks do not like risk. Mm-hmm. And telling the federal government, yeah, we have clients that that buy and sell weed. Mm. That could be an issue. And so you end up having basically things that stay inside of states. So you have an industry growing inside of California that doesn't leave the state, because if it does, now you've got federal problems.
Interesting. Okay.
And that's what you wouldn't see in other types of verticals. And insurance, it's mostly dealing with ever-changing regulations and trying to handle the increasing complexity of doing insurance, whether it's property or life or health.
And you're telling me in the insurance space, there are like disruptors that are out there selling an MVP.
They are trying to scale their MVP, or they have a long-standing system that worked when things were a lot simpler, but things are no longer simple.
So I'm ignoring those people now, though. So those are the monolith people, right?
Right. Yeah. And I use monolith as a term for basically, also means legacy, also means not built to take advantage of modern affordances like the cloud. It's not cloud native. So it ends up being a catch-all for, you know, everything that isn't that.
Right. Yep. I get that. So I'm trying, and when I saw insurance, I was like, it feels like we're oozing into legacy. If there are disruptors that have, or even it could be a air quotes legacy company that did get, I don't know, maybe it's internally funded or whatever, but they created a brand new thing, and it's not based on their old way, you know, something they built in the 80s with COBOL. It's a new thing, you know, if Intuit made FreshBooks as like a side bet, you know what I mean? So is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Or like, are there legacy companies that are in this, that are trying to disrupt themselves basically?
Not as much. It's more of, you know, smaller players. With the legacy companies, they're not so much trying to disrupt themselves as they had that other problem that we're ignoring now. You know, they're trying to react to the fact that their system no longer does what it needs to for them. So they're having the other issue that isn't as acute.
Okay. So yeah, it's in my mind, I'm visualizing like the legacy people are trying to turn the Queen Mary, and these other people are trying to pack more people onto a jet ski. So very, very different. Okay. So let's stick with the jet ski people, continue to stick with the jet ski people. So I'm kind of crossing off insurance there, unless you tell me that there are a bunch of, like, there's a lot of activity in this space.
A surprisingly number of people on my email list hail from an insurance background, which I did not expect.
But they're the jet ski people, or are they the Queen Mary people?
They're the Queen Mary people.
Okay, so forget about them. Yeah. So if we're talking jet ski, there's tons of that in fintech. I happen to know that that's true.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And give me one more. So we've got jet ski people, or marijuana industry, fintech. Give me one more.
Would you all do alcohol and beverage sales, or no?
If there are disruptors, you know, if there's jet ski people there.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like there would be, but
no, they're again, when I talk to potential clients, I've talked to clients in this space, who've had these issues. But it was not very many. So it could be a sample size problem, or it could just be, there aren't very many people that are dealing with that in the space.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's see. The other one, as I said before, people in the machine learning space, that's and the AI space, those are spaces that are both growing. And typically, though, they're not using, when they are using .NET, they're using it because that's what they knew before.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not using it because, oh, gosh, you know, .NET's the best for AI. No, they're using it because I know .NET, and I want to do this new AI thing. So let me use, you know, ML.NET, and let me use that, and let me grow a business off that.
Okay, but what businesses are the most obvious? Because that's just a tool.
Right. So I don't have a good answer for that, because it's one of those spaces that I'm not in. And so I just see the effects of the space. So I just see people flocking to it, not necessarily what their business is behind flocking to it.
Exactly. Okay. So fintech, what's another one? What about remote work, like sort of B2B remote work, like Zoom and other collaboration tools? Has that been something you've
not people across. I've talked to, like, for instance, the people I've talked to in my list or in my social networks, mainly Twitter, not that I've seen in those. There is one that is B2C home delivery in that space. So more of those are cropping up. Yeah, the things that center around how to get things to the house that consumers want. So
if you had a bunch of leads, let's say, and one of them was B2C instead of B2B, would you be like, I don't know? Or would you be like, yeah, that's fine?
Yeah, no, I'd be like, yeah, that's fine. The problem doesn't change. Maybe the scale at which we have to fix it changes. Mm-hmm. If you've got 5 million people using your system, it's a lot different than 5,000.
Right.
But the problem itself doesn't change.
Okay. All right. So, So I feel like we've identified three, hypothetically, the hypothesis is that there are at least three, probably a lot more, of these jet ski type people who are, you know, I don't know, trying to pull a tugboat with a jet ski, however you want to use the metaphor. Tell me more about what the ideal company size is. Like, give me a sense of the company that would be your client that's got this MVP. Is it a 10-person firm, 100-person firm, 1,000-person firm? Like, what's the, you know, and just to give some context there, generally I have found that when a company gets big enough, they don't always need an outside consultant because they can hire that person as a FTE, full-time employee. And when they're too small, maybe they don't have enough budget to afford your exorbitant rates.
You're right.
So there's like a sweet spot where the company's pretty big and there's a, you know, I would think these particular kinds, they're going to have a revenue stream. So it's not like there's just pie in the sky. We're trying to make an MVP and see if anything sticks. You know, these people have something to lose and they see not only something to lose, but they see a window of opportunity that's probably closing. And so they're going to be in a big rush. What in your experience is the best size for you in terms of, let's say, headcount? It could be other ways that you could measure it, but let's just say headcount.
Yeah, tech team would be under, definitely under 50, probably under 25. Company size, definitely under 500, most likely under 250, or just getting close to that. So probably, you know, between 50 and, I would say between 50 and 250 on the company size, and the tech team, the people responsible both for operations and development, would have to be under probably between 10 and 50 at the outside. Once you start getting above that, you've got all of, as you said, you've got all of the institutional knowledge that you need to solve this problem on your own generally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So do you personally have any problem working in the marijuana space, or would you prefer, if you had to pick between weed, fintech, and home delivery, who would you rather hang around with?
Yeah, so I'd rather not hang around with fintech because they're not my kind of people, but the marijuana people are also they're cooler, but there are social stigmas around that. So fintech, you know, from a business perspective, it would make most sense and least stigmatizing to go with someone like fintech. But
when you say make the most sense, what do you mean?
In that it's the most socially acceptable. It is going to have a lot of growth in the space.
I thought you said first you wouldn't want that one.
Well, I mean, from like a, gosh, do I want to hang out with finance folks all day? And the answer is probably not. But you know, that's one of the three industries that's growing here. Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting I find that fascinating that it sounds like you're considering, when you say social stigma, you mean that you care about personally. You don't want to tell.
That I care about because people in my, people with my background care about it. So let's say none of this worked out and I had to go find a job again. I live in the Northern Virginia area, right outside mm-hmm. of DC. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of government and government-centered jobs out here. And if this didn't work out, I went back to them and said, hey, I'd like to get my clearance back and work in them. They're like, you worked in the marijuana space. And I'm like, yes, I did. And that would be an instant no.
Okay.
And so that's why, like, I don't have any personal issues with it. But if I, as a fallback, if all of this failed, then it would be difficult for me to get a job in this area, in or around the government space, which is most of the jobs in this area.
Got it. Okay. Well, what about home delivery then, if you don't really care for finance people?
Let's go with finance people, but home delivery would definitely be an option.
Okay. Right. And, you know, and I think I would guess, I don't, this is probably another huge assumption, but I would guess that there's going to be a difference between jet ski fintech people or finance people and Queen Mary finance people. Could be wrong. But I would imagine that they're going to be a little bit more creative and entrepreneurial and less status quo-y and buttoned up, but who knows? Okay. So if we were going to look for,
and that's true too. You know, when I think of fintech, I do think of the large, Queen Mary types. And so yeah. I could just have a misperception of the startups in the space.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it would be pretty cool to work at Square or Venmo even. I mean, Venmo is PayPal, but, you know, one of these whippersnappers, it could be cool. I don't know. I really don't know, but I do have other students that do serve fintech, and there are just thousands of these upstarts that are getting funded. So many of them.
Yeah, so Stripe would be fun. Square would be fun. Venmo, you know, PayPal would be okay. So yeah, those are okay companies. It's the larger ones that I'm maybe have a different perception of.
Yeah, I mean, Stripe. There's so many. I think it could be cool. Anyway, could be cool. so that you're not doomed to a life of white button down shirts. Okay, so if you were going to look for fintechs that had 50 to 250 employees, with a tech team between 10 and 50 people that had a seed round or something like that, where would you look?
The LinkedIn sales navigator.
Yes, that is right.
That is the first place I would look. I recently bought a subscription to it, and it's wonderful for finding these sorts of things. And that's how I got in touch with all of my potential clients when I was first trying to niche down like B2B SaaS CTOs. I found them all through that, and it's wonderful.
Okay. And is it the CTO that you would talk to about this stuff, or would it be the CEO, do you think?
I don't know enough to know if the CEO would see the issue. I know the CTO would see the issue, but might lack agency to fix it, or lack the, you know, the budget to fix it if they're not, you know, if they're not on the board. And in some cases they are, in some cases they aren't. And then they have to go to the board and try to get them to spend this money.
Oh, well, let's explore that a little bit, because it's slightly surprising for me to hear that, but I'm sure you can clarify. So what? Tell me more about the problem that a jet ski company would have at this particular point in time.
Yeah, they would be typically, as I've seen, they would be trying to scale up, and they would be having outages, depending on the type of company, outages on their big sales days. Or having, you know, they are not able to go after new markets as quickly as the CEO would like. So the CEO is saying, hey, you know, we need to be in this new market in 3 months. And the CTO is like, yeah, that's going to be a problem.
Why? Just because of load?
Load, definitely. Decisions made in the past under different sets of circumstances by the development team.
Can you make that concrete?
Sure. So they've decided that they're going to, you know, store all their data in SQL Server, which is great, but they're going to use triggers to handle auditing and updates. And then when you get to a certain point of complexity or of size, the triggers start to make your database fall over. Now that is another space that someone like Brent Ozar goes in with SQL Server performance. But if you want to get out of it, there are other ways where you don't have to, you know, actually try to deal with the database part. You can actually do it in other ways. And those other ways are where I come in.
Okay, so they can't expand to new markets, not because that, somebody hard coded the Virginia regulations into the code base, and they can't easily expand to West Virginia or something. So it's not that. It's the like load.
Yeah, and it can be the former, but it typically isn't. It's typically something load oriented, or something that, hey, we got to this we get this size and we're seeing memory pressure that we would otherwise wouldn't see, and we don't know how to fix that. And also from the monolithic point of view, if they're still operating as a monolith, they don't have the ability to horizontally scale.
Don't confuse yourself. Forget about monolith. Stick to jet ski. So like that's like I know it's difficult, but for this exercise, like that's the thing. Like let's niche down and find exactly what the problems are.
Yeah. Well, so when I use monolith, I don't necessarily mean something large. I mean something that is a single deployable that can't be horizontally scaled.
Fair enough. Okay.
So the horizontal scaling is a particular problem. They see that as a solution. I want to horizontally scale. I can't with the current status of my system. It does not horizontally scale, but I want to. And that's one issue they see.
Okay, so you're just talking about the architecture of the.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I was conflating that with legacy. Okay, so what are some other things that the CEO doesn't want to hear from the CTO? CEO says make this happen, and the CTO says sorry. So can't they're having outages on big days. I'm guaranteed the CEO knows about that
Yes.
and doesn't like it. Can't expand into larger markets. Guaranteed the CEO knows about that because. He's probably he or she is surely the person that wants it and is getting a no. What other things would a CEO request that they just get a not the reason why it's a no, but what are other things that they would get a no?
It could be the CEO saying, I want to move to the cloud. And just because that's a buzzword. And the CTO could be saying, no, we can't do that. That would be one other thing. And that goes along with the horizontal scaling. Usually no one wants to move to the cloud because they want to move to the cloud. They want to move to the cloud to get rid of their data centers. And they want to move to the cloud so they can horizontally scale their application because that's easier than trying to vertically scale an application.
Okay. That sounds a little bit like a solution masquerading as a problem, but okay,
Yeah.
I'll take it. All right. It's basically a load thing.
Yes.
Okay. So,
In some way, shape, or form, it does not perform the way it needs to at a critical time.
okay. Is there much in the way of, there's probably not much in the way that those older, like the legacy ones that have, regression errors and stuff like that. I feel like there probably would be less of that, but you tell me, like, is the CEO, are there, never mind the load-based outages, are there like a lot of bugs in production? Are there embarrassing show-stopping bugs or like lots of, I don't know, like a really bad UX or other brand damaging complaints that these people are likely to be getting?
Now, all of those things, because they're trying to move so fast, and their system does not allow them to move that fast. And so you end up having regression bugs. You end up having showstoppers. You end up having, late night deployments and redeployments, on call issues, where the tier three support has to be, on call because we're having these things happen at 2 o'clock in the morning regularly when we batch update. And so they end up getting pulled into those, which ends up, increasing turnover and stress on the development team.
So, when you say they're trying, so is it, if I was going to put that another way, are you saying that they're basically duct taping things onto this thing that just fundamentally can't support what they're trying to do and that creates a lot of bug? Like you said, they're trying to move fast.
Yeah. So the impact you see is that we want to add new features, so we feel pressure to add new features, even though we know in our hearts we've actually got to re-architect this thing. But we're feeling pressure to add new features, so we're going to add them at the speed the business wants, which ends up compounding the problem. And so they end up seeing, the impact is you see these regressions, you see these showstopper bugs, you see these severity one incidents more and
How
more.
and what how would those be communicated to the CEO? So CEO gets a message from someone on the board or VC or some VIP And it's like, hey, your site's, there's what? There's what? There's a...
Your site's 500ing, let's say. Or, you know, we're not seeing new products on your site. Or, you know, hey, I can't, we can't place orders.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Your supplier's calling you. We can't place orders.
Suppliers call. Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. So maybe the site's not down.
Right. It's just having lots of issues where the people that need to place orders or the people that need to get updates from your system or the people that want to use your system are running into problems.
Okay. So I'm trying to get real crispy on what the problems are. What would the supplier say?
Your site's not letting me place orders. It would be whatever their, you know, whatever goal they're trying to accomplish.
Right. But give me one. Give me a more specific one. Like, can you think of a time that this happened in your history? Like, is there a story that you can remember?
Yes. So in one case, it was the giant sales day for this industry, and on April 20th, and their site could not handle the load of people coming to try to, you know, buy from their marketplace of weed.
Yeah.
And so April like 20th. They, yeah. And so they were running into, the system was going up and down. There were actual, delays in database writes and just the entire, it was a very stressful time and it kept happening. And so they would, you know, they did not, know the system as well because it was an outsourced MVP, that they were trying to grow. And so they did not have the institutional knowledge to be able to dive in and be like, ah, here's how I fix this. And it ended up hitting them year after year.
Year after year.
Year after year. And they've been trying to, they might have finally did it. But last my conversation was they've been trying to get off of and just rewrite because they feel like that's easier than trying to, you know, have the expertise and get the expertise and figure out the problem with this system. But they're now running into all the problems of a rewrite.
God. Okay. Just taking some notes here. All right. So I think I was hoping for a couple of other maybe secondary or tertiary symptoms that the CEO would be suffering from, but it's really load. It's outages. If that's one of the problems, it's the biggest one.
Like, yeah.
So, and there's all different ways that it could be caused, like big sales day or just trying to expand into a larger market or whatever the reasons are, more people are trying to get on the jet ski. It's going to sink. It just keeps sinking. So, you know, putting a, you know, whatever, some new horn on it, like some new feature on it, isn't going to change the fact that we can't handle more people.
Right.
So this is, what are some of the other than the site being down, obviously, what are the things that, or let me ask it in the dumbest possible way. Why is it bad that there are outages on big sales days?
Yeah, they're losing money and their investors. So they're losing money from two ends, right? Their investors are losing confidence in them. Mm-hmm. And they can't make sales they need to make to stay alive. Mm-hmm. Those are the two ends they're getting hit from.
Okay. Investors losing confidence, business losing money. What about their customers?
Yeah. So the customers are the ones that are, you know, seeing these poor reputation for years. I mean, we still know what the word fail whale means from Twitter.
Yeah. Right?
They haven't had one in years and we still know what it is.
Yeah.
So they're losing brand reputation, with their customers.
Yep. And especially with B2B, that's real bad.
Right.
All right. So CEO's your buyer here. I mean, like, it's not the CTO. I mean, it could be the CTO, but why not go for the CEO? If you've got problems that a CEO knows about, outages on big sales days, you know, and what does that cause? That causes you to straight up lose out on money. It causes your investors to lose confidence in you. It causes brand damage and destroys your reputation. Like, those are all CEO things, and they're really bad for somebody who's trying to build a business like this. So this is, I mean, for this kind of, scale up MVP disruptor kind of company, I mean, that's super crispy. I mean, that is like, yeah, if someone's feeling those pains and they believe that there's someone to talk to about that. So what, let's flip it around. What do they wish? What would be like if you could wave a magic wand, CEO, what would things be like?
Yeah, they would be able to handle any customer coming to their site. They would not lose a single dollar in a sale. They would not lose face with their investors, right?
Investors would be blown away, right? Investors would be like, here's more money.
Exactly.
Okay. Anything about, we didn't say anything about competitors in the pain section. Would there be, is there anything else that the, anything that's a little bit more specific, maybe less of a big deal, but more specific? So let's say, is there something in fintech where there's a regulatory body or auditors or something that's, because we could say these things about any space where there's a SaaS involved. Is there something specific to fintech that is unique that would be part of the pain or part of the dream? Like maybe it's some sort of, failure. Maybe they're required to have some kind of audit trail, and like when the database writes were screwed up, they had to redo them by hand, or they were just lost and there was a big fine. Or is there anything specific to them?
No, that's exactly what they see. They have to keep an audit trail. They have to be able to say this is where this came from and this is how this happened. There are lots of regulatory bodies in the financial space, and there's also compliance as you get larger, like SOC, that you have to actually try to architect your system so that it complies, so that you can sell to larger, or that you can be as a, in the B2B sense, that you can be a supplier or be a part of the chain for larger companies.
Okay, so that, so when you say compliance, it's government compliance, but it's required by certain companies in order to, for you to be selected. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And what's the biggest regulation, or I don't know how to say it. Like, what's the biggest thing that, like, what's the HIPAA for this space?
SOC and SOC 2. They contain these audits that basically says, your system and your corporation complies with, the SOC 2 audit standard.
Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And that's, system and organizational controls is what SOC stands for.
Is it SOC?
SOC, yeah. And it covers security, availability, how they process data, confidentiality, and of course, data breaches, so customer privacy.
Okay. And how would you say, whatever, your software is out of SOC 2 compliance or something, or
They would be
you
trying to get,
fear.
yeah, they would be trying to get into that space, so they would be trying to make their systems SOC 2 compliant. So it's generally, it's one of those things where it's not a psychographic, but it's a transition point for a company where we went from we didn't need it to now we're trying to sell to bigger companies. Now we need it.
Okay, great. Great, great, great. All right, cool. So, and we've got a great crispy, we've got first, we got a ideal buyer, CEO of this kind of company. I won't re reiterate again. Some really expensive pains, some really attractive dreams. So what is a fix? So like if we imagine that you've got most people when they're, a consultant or a freelancer or developer or whatever, they start out doing custom projects. So let's just say that in a perfect world, if you had lots of resources, the client was basically gives you a blank check. How would you run an engagement to remediate these outages?
So it'd be first, it would try to figure out what part of the system is actually causing the problem.
So it'd start with an audit of some kind.
That's right. So an assessment, basically go through, run the system, see where there's some scripts you can run the system, profile the system, and say, okay, where are we actually having our biggest issues? And I should actually back up. That's the first technical thing that you do. The first non-technical thing you do is to actually talk to both, you know, the people that are responsible for building and maintaining the system and people that maybe use the system or what the purpose of the system is, so that you can get an understanding of, you know, what is the invariant? How does the system supposed to operate? You know, what input comes in and what things do we deliver? So what is the customer asking for versus here's what I give them and here's the, all the steps that my system has to go through to make that happen. And then it's diving into, you know, how does the system actually work? What is it doing right now? And that gives you a sense of the pieces involved. And the reason why I want to know what pieces are involved is that in some cases, fixing the system is, you know, breaking it up. So back to the word monolith, right? Mm-hmm. By default, all software is monolithic. We're just now starting to develop cloud native and what we call microservices. And so part, you know, a solution may be, let's break the system up into the discrete pieces and then have those pieces be decoupled from each other so that we can horizontally scale the pieces that need to scale. And so that we can keep the changes away from the parts of the system that need not change. Because when it's a monolith, it's all going to change. And if you break the system up, then you're able to control what changes happen to what part of the system. And you're also able to decouple the system so that you can scale the parts that you need to scale. And that may mean involving or implementing something called an event-driven architecture, which is a different way of thinking about how little services communicate with each other.
Yeah, let's not get that deep yet. So,
but that's where the solution would tend to head in my space.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
in my space.
Dating ourselves. Okay, so number one, I would call it stakeholder interviews.
Yes.
And then you do an auditing procedure.
Yes.
And then you would architect a solution.
Yes, I try to give three possible solutions. So what is the stopgap thing we can do right now? Mm-hmm. As one? What is the, all right, if we want to get the stopgap and we want to not have to revisit this in the long term. So if you don't just want to Band-Aid, if you actually want to fix the problem, mm-hmm. here's what we would do. And then the third one is, you know, whatever, it doesn't fit in the other two buckets. So it may mean, you know, let's re-architect the system. It may also mean, no, let's just, you know, focus on this particular piece. So if it's the database, let's focus all of our energy on, you know, re-architecting this part of it so that that doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. But that could take time. So you want that stopgap. Hey, if we could do something that would only take, you know, less than a month, what could we do? But that can be a stopgap or it can be part of the long-term solution. So you want to separate it out in case it's, you know, in case it goes against a long-term solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you would have found out from stakeholder interviews, things like how much runway do you have? How fast does this have to happen? What, you know, all these business details, correct?
Right. All of those contexts that we don't tend to think about as developers, but that are important. So the financial context, the business context, the cultural context, what will the team and what will the business actually let you change?
Right.
And then of course, the technical context, if I didn't already say that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So once you've come up with these sort of like, you know, good, better, best, or like near term, long term, and maybe something in between, once you come up with these options, these different architectural options, you would presumably present that to leadership. And then they would make some kind of determination based on your recommendations and the feelings of the other stakeholders, like what the best plan would be. I guess, plan.
Right. What's their appetite for change?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And at that point, somebody's got to do it. And so there's like, so what would you do next? Or what, you know, again, if they've got a blank check, you like them, they like you, what would happen after the architecture is selected and approved?
Yeah. So I give them the option of, you know, hey, I can, you can just keep me on call and I can help you through this. Like an advisory retainer, or I can go further and say, hey, I can actually exercise technical oversight of this so that I will make sure that it stays, you know, whoever you hire, I will make sure it stays on the rails. I will make sure that it doesn't go against, you know, the architecture of what we're actually trying to achieve. I'll make sure we don't fall in any holes along the way. Because typically if the team could do this, they would have already done this and they wouldn't need me. So by the fact that they're doing this for the first time, means that they don't quite know what they're doing yet with this. And then the third one would be, hey, I can actually do this for you. So, you know, I can interface between you and a team that I hire to do this. And we can, you know, work together to get it done. Because typically time is the concern. They don't want to spend a year. They don't want to spend 6 months. I mean, they probably spend 6 months, but they don't want to. So anything they can get, you know, sooner is better. And usually they're at this point, they're willing to throw money at it. But that goes back to the architectural problem, because if you've got an old team and a new team working, you know, one's trying to split it out and the other team's trying to add features to it, you've got a lot that you've got to worry about. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, in that conversation of giving them the three approaches initially, short, medium term, you know, where you said good, better, and best, it's a conversation about, okay, all right, you want, you know, do you really want to re-architect this thing and you want someone else, another team to do it next to your team? Because that's got its own issues.
Right.
So.
Okay. So, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit in the coaching Slack, and it all aligns with, I think the product, in a sense, you're describing a product ladder. You know, you've got, you could sell the sort of diagnostic recommendations thing unto itself, the kind of audit that, well, actually remind me, because we've so many people talking to in there around similar things. What stuff are you currently selling? Like, what do you have on your website that you currently offer?
I offer right now the assessment, or the roadmap, the architectural roadmap, and then I offer the advisory retainer. And I don't say I offer custom projects, but I offer custom projects.
Right. Like, if you find the right thing and they're like, oh, we really would like it. Yeah. So cool. Smart. All right. And it feels to me, the thing that's different for me from this conversation than from previous in Slack is that it feels like, just personally for me, I have way more clarity on the distinction between these two, what I've been calling the Queen Mary and the jet ski kinds of clients, where before I feel like previous conversations in my mind, it was less clear about who the client might be. And it was more, you know, we've had conversations in the past about, like, you know, worldview type stuff and like things should be architected this way in general, or, you know, so on and so forth, and like more horizontal. This is a lot less horizontal. This feels a lot less horizontal than before. I don't know. Is that true for you too? Or is this all like obvious to you? And it's really me that's kind of getting the clarity.
No, it was not obvious to me at all, because from my perspective, I didn't see a difference between the old and stodgy that had a monolith that they were trying to, you know, increase the longevity of, versus the young upstart that decided that, hey, we actually have an acute problem here. To me, they were the same, because the solution is the same.
So the solution's the same, right?
Right. And that was the problem I was having. So this has been very helpful into, hey, you know, it used to be, I would say, I help B2B SaaS's scale up their .NET monolith, or I help .NET teams, you know, move to microservices or event-driven architecture. That's what I used to say. But now I can actually go in and say, hey, FinTech, you know,
FinTech CEO.
Right, exactly. Are you having these issues? If so, I can help. And then less on what I do and how I do it, and more on solving the problems that they have. So this has been really useful.
Oh, good.
In that regard.
That's my favorite. Yeah, I mean, like, when you started talking about event-driven architecture, I was like waving my hands like, no.
No,
that'll
I'm going
happen.
To sleep now.
Right. That conversation is super important, but that's after the sale. That conversation's after the sale. Or it might even be when you are doing the stakeholder interviews and trying to come up with something that's feasible for the constraints that this particular company has. Like, I could imagine a situation where you're like, wow, this company is not going to be able to handle it. They don't have enough time or budget or something. There could be some constraints where the best practices can't be applied in their situation. So you have to do something really smart. That's where a consultant can come in and say, like, yeah, all the advice you're going to get online is like X, and it's not wrong, but it won't work for you because of reasons 1, 2, and 3. So we need to come up with something clever and improvise and do something that's going to keep the ship afloat, or the jet ski afloat, to torture the metaphor.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, great. Okay, so I'm glad to hear.
Yeah, that's exactly why I reached out, because, you know, going two levels down into how I do it doesn't matter. And what I've been doing in the past and how I've solved these problems in the past has varied. It's not always been adopt X. It's been, you know, whatever works for the context for the situation. And that's why I felt like I was floundering with my current positioning, because my current positioning was focused on what I do and how I do it, which I wouldn't do all the time. And but then it leads to people that only want when they have that particular, you know, they already think that's a solution that they approach you. And but that's not what I want. I want the problem to be where people approach me. I'm, you know, a fintech company having outages or running into, you know, acute regulatory problems. And I work and I happen to have a .NET system. Can you help? Now, right. The question becomes, should, if I'm talking to the CEO, should the tech stack, should I even mention that part?
Hey, when you just said .NET, I was shaking my head. I was like, it doesn't. Well, you tell me, does it matter? I mean, I would be personally a little bit reluctant to take like, you know, a shop that's essentially using Linux for everything. You know, there's sort of Apache open source hippie people like me. I would be reluctant to like, okay, we're going to move everything over to Microsoft and be like,
Well, .NET is also, Microsoft is now getting hippie too. Like they run on Linux, they have .NET Core. So they're, you know, in the past few years have been expanding into that space and actually making it so .NET wasn't Windows only. And that's great. But that's a very new, relatively new development in the life of .NET. That's only been the past 3 or 4 years where that's been a thing.
That's fair. And that's cool. And I'm glad to hear that. But still, they're not going to have, if they don't have any .NET talent on staff, that could potentially be a constraint and just be like, So yeah. The question is, if they were, I don't know, if it was a Python shop, I don't even know, like if it was something else, would you be able to help?
Yes, because I only say yes because I have, there's always architectural things, whether or not the implementation is different, there's always architectural things that you can do. And those are pretty consistent among stacks. But I also have Python experience. I have, you know, JavaScript systems experience, Python systems experience. But that's the only reason I could say yes to that. If I didn't understand the intricacies of Python, I would not be able to help them solve those problems.
Right. So here's my thought. Like, I would probably really minimize any mention of .NET if you're reaching out to CEOs and you're getting traction, and it's just turning out that all of them are like, name something that you would say no to. Like, I can't help you with that. Like, I don't know, COBOL or
yeah, I can't help you with that.
Yeah. So if somebody came along and was just like, I would probably just deal with it at the stage. I would deal with it conversationally and just be like, you know, if let's just say, you know, you changed your LinkedIn headline to hey, fintech CEO, are you struggling with SOC 2 compliance or are you having outages on your biggest sales days or whatever it ends up being, or I help fintech CEOs scale or whatever the thing is. And let's just say you find something that starts to get people reaching out to you, you know, you start to have conversations. I would probably just handle the stack in the conversations. And I wouldn't anywhere near lead with it. And if they said something like COBOL or whatever, you know, I would still politely help them to the extent that I could in the phone call and say, you know, I'm not really familiar with COBOL. I wouldn't be comfortable, but maybe I could, you know, put you in touch with someone, or maybe, you know, and maybe over time there's some, you know, you end up with a little black book of people you can refer work to if it's just not going to be a good fit for you because of the tech stack. But I think, if you're operating at a level like this, is a very high level strategic architectural level, the implementation details shouldn't matter. They will start to matter more and more as time goes on with the project. So like, the longer you engage, the more they're going to matter. But to do like, to do some of these things like an assessment or, you know, some of that stuff, probably, you tell me, it might not matter what stack it's on, or there, you just are attracting lots of .NET people by accident, you know, and you can just not even worry about it.
Yeah. So it goes back to what we said before. They're all going to have the similar patterns of issues in the implementations. The implementations might, you know, the fix might be different, or the problem might manifest itself in an implementation in a different way. Mm-hmm. But they're all going to have the problems.
Yep. So if you were doing, let's say you're just doing project oversight, or let's say you do a turnkey implementation and you bring in a crackerjack COBOL team, and it's your job to really have the highest level of involvement at keeping the train on the tracks. Like, would that be within your, would you be comfortable with that, or would you think that would be a mistake?
I wouldn't know. Yeah, I think that would be a mistake only because I wouldn't know how to source. I mean, there's probably so few COBOL people left that the ones that are still doing it are the rock stars. Mm. But my issue is if it's not in the stack I've worked before, I wouldn't know how to source the people to solve the problem. That's the difficulty.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So there's a boundary line there.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I wouldn't even bother. Leading, I would certainly not lead with it. I might not even bother mentioning it. Maybe down in your bio, it's like, hi, I'm George. I've been a .NET expert or whatever you want to say in your bio. And maybe it's mentioned somewhere, like not saying hide it, but I think to optimize for conversations and just focus way, way down on the ideal buyer, which we've defined clearly here, and figure out how to get on their radar in a way, so that when they either when they eventually do have an outage or they're having let's say they're not currently having outages, at least they'll be like positioned, you'll be positioned in their mind as the guy to call when the MVP starts falling over, or maybe they know someone that is in that situation. And so you can meet them at the right time, So, I mean, if we back up, the whole point of position is to make you memorable so that when the time comes, yours is the name that pops into their head. So, yeah. So if you were aligned with, I don't know what we would call it exactly, but I feel like it's clearly defined. It just needs to be clearly articulated in a way that's perhaps a little snappy or catchy or memorable, but very clear, so.
Yeah. And to reiterate, that's the problem that I'm having currently is that I'm not able to trigger a Rolodex moment while I help .NET team scale their tech. That's just so broad to not, can he solve this problem? Can he solve that problem? But focusing and you helping me focus on a vertical allows me to say the problem in the way the vertical would encounter it and not in a vague, wishy-washy scale their tech way, but an actual problem they have. And so I would rather have more conversations and conversations that I could say no to than my current state, which is having very few conversations.
Yeah,
because it's a lot of, there's so many layers to get through before we can figure out whether we should have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Great. Cool. We could probably talk all day. We should probably wrap up. Where can people go to put you in touch with fintech CEOs who are having outages or ask you more questions or make suggestions or let you know that they're a rockstar COBOL developer that you could hire?
Yeah. So my website is creatively called georgestocker.com, which is also my name, STOCKER. And you can find me on there and how to contact me in any way you'd like.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming on, George.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that's it for this time. I'm Jonathan Stark, and you have been listening to Ditching Hourly. Bye. Hey, Jonathan again. Do you have questions about how to improve your business? Things like value pricing your work instead of billing for your time, or positioning yourself as the go-to person in your space, or maybe productizing your services so you never have to have another awkward sales call or spend hours writing another custom proposal? Book a one-on-one coaching call with me and get answers to these questions and others in the time it takes you to get ready for work in the morning. Best of all, you're covered by my 100% satisfaction guarantee. If at the end of the call you don't feel like it was worth it, just say the word and I'll refund your purchase in full. To book your one-on-one coaching call, go to jonathanstark.com/call, C-A-L-L. That URL again is jonathanstark.com/call. Hope to see you there.